This is disc number two.
What do you think happened?
Don't know, Glory. It's past me. But that man's bad medicine. Snaky.
What if it turns out Nathan was with him?
I may be sheriff, but it won't be settled in no goddamn court of law.
They turned onto a side street and followed a path beaten down in the snow. Saw families huddled before fireplaces in those cabins on the hillside that were still inhabited. Tiny islands of warmth and light in the storm.
Need to warn you, Ezekiel, she said. I want to say something about our little whistle.
Ezekiel stopped, faced his wife. It was so dark outside he could only make out the whites of her eyes.
Told you, we don't talk about it.
The tremor in his voice was grief, not anger, and it made Gloria's throat tighten.
I just need to say something, Zeke. You don't gotta talk.
He grabbed her arms.
Said I don't want to hear it.
But I need you to,
she said, and her eyes burned as they flooded.
I can't go on tonight and tomorrow pretending it's like it's always been. Only been a year and I miss him. That's all I wanted to say, that I miss Gus so much. I can't breathe when I think about him.
Her husband's eyes went wide. He turned away from her, his nose running.
I'm empty, Zeke, 'cause we don't talk about him. That don't make nothing better. Just makes us forget, and do you want to forget your son?
Ezekiel sat in the snow.
I ain't forgot Gus. Ain't nothing in this whole goddamn world make me forget my boy.
She knelt behind him, Ezekiel wiping his face and cursing.
You reckon we'll see Gus again when we die?
Glory, if I believed that, I'd have blowed my goddamn head off a year ago. This is above my bend.
Why are you doing this to me?
'Cause I don't remember what he looks like. He's just a blur in my head.
Remember that day I wanted to get our picture made and you wouldn't?
Yeah.
Well, goddamn you for that, Zeke.
The wind had changed directions and the snow needled Gloria's face. She turned her back to the barrage of ice. Ezekiel was saying something, but she couldn't hear. She moved forward, their faces inches apart. She asked him what he'd said.
Said he came halfway above my knee. Close your eyes, Glory, maybe you can see him. His hair was fine, color of rust, and his skin was so white. We used to say it looked like milk. He had your eyes.
Ezekiel cleared his throat and wiped his face again.
And when I... Jesus... When I kissed his neck, my mustache would tickle him, and he'd laugh so hard, scream, "No, Papa!"
Gloria had closed her eyes.
Keep going, Zeke.
And he called my knee his horsey, and he named it Benjamin.
Ezekiel had stopped. Gloria opened her eyes. Her husband was shaking. He leaned forward into her cape and wept.
"It's okay," she whispered. "It's all right."
"No, it ain't," he said. "I lie in bed sometimes and try to picture what Gus would have looked like at 10 or 15 or 30. I imagine him turned out a man. We was robbed, Glory. It ain't never gonna be all right again."
Ezekiel picked himself up and then lifted Gloria in his arms, both covered in snow. She bawled as Ezekiel carried her up the hill toward their dark cabin in the grove of spruce. 10. Bart Packer glided through the darkness in his sleigh, the whisper of the runners drowned out by the clinking of chain loops and the single tree groaning in the cold. A half mile south of town, and with the snow blowing in every direction, he could hardly see beyond the horses. He'd have missed it, but the horses knew the way, making the turn just past the grouping of snow-loaded firs. They pulled the sled up a series of switchbacks and after a while slowed to a walk, their legs punching through the snow, their nostrils flaring like bellows. Bart slapping the reins against their rumps, hollering,
"Get up there! Go on, girls!"
They climbed several hundred feet above the floor of the box canyon. The trail leveled out.
"Now get on!"
he yelled, and he worked the reins furiously until the horses trotted in the powder. He wasn't rushing them out of meanness or impatience. Nothing riled Bart like the mistreatment of horses. but they were approaching the most dangerous section of the ride home, where the trail passed through a gap between steep slopes that produced slides every winter. If caught in an avalanche tonight, he'd have almost no chance of survival. When the sled had passed safely through the gap, Bart drew up the reins and brought the horses to a halt. He stepped down into the snow. It rose to his waist. He unfastened an axe from the side of the sleigh and waded over to a pool of ice the size of a wagon wheel. He hacked at the mouth of the spring, chipping away the ice until he could see water flowing down the rock. He let the horses blow. While they drank, he climbed into the sleigh and pulled a flask from a pocket of his wool overcoat, then leaned back, wrapped in the buffalo robe, sipping brandy, listening to the pair of horses slurp the icy water. Maybe it was the alcohol, but he imagined his lips tingled from their contact with Miss Hartman. He replayed the kiss. Why had he waited so long?
"'Cause of your pride, man, your fucking pride.
The horses lifted their heads and neighed. They backed away from the spring and stomped their hooves. Bart grabbed up the reins.
What is it, girls?
His first thought was they'd sensed a slide. He peered up, listening for the rumble of snow raging down through the darkness above him. Heard only the horses nervously clicking their teeth on the steel bits. He took a final swig of brandy, stuffed the flask into his coat, and had just lifted the reins to put his team into motion when one of the horses snorted. Bart cocked his head, strained to listen. He heard the whoosh of animals struggling through deep snow. Two riders appeared 20 feet up the trail, their horses buried to their stomachs. It occurred to Bart that they resembled phantoms in the snow. He blinked, half expecting them to have vanished when his eyes opened, but they were still there, and close enough that he could see the clouds of vapor pluming from their horses' nostrils.
"Evening," Bart called out.
There was no answer, and he thought maybe they hadn't heard him, so he yelled,
"Merry Christmas!"
The rider on the left said something to his companion, and Bart heard the click of tongues. The riders came up on either side of the sleigh. They wore wide-brimmed hats topped with several inches of snow, had draped themselves in blankets and wrapped their faces in pieces of torn muslin shirt so that Bart could only see their eyes. Those belonging to the rider on his left exuded a cold focus. The other pair of eyes were wide and twitching with fear and nerves.
"Merry Christmas," Bart said, more cheer in his voice than he felt, and wondered if he was facing a couple of road agents. "Hell of a storm. Ain't on the prod, just trying to get my ass to a fire. I'd appreciate you shutting that fucking hole in your face."
The rider on the left had spoken, his voice low, metallic. Bart said,
"Sir, I'm sorry, I don't understand what the problem."
The business end of a double-barreled scattergun peeked out from under the rider's blanket.
"You shoot that gun, sir, you're liable to bring a slide down on us all."
"Didn't you hear what he said?"
Bart looked at the rider on his right. He was smaller than his partner, much younger, barely a man, if that. But what struck Bart was his accent, pure Tennessee.
"I don't understand," Bart said. "You work for me, son."
The boy's eyes darted to his companion, then back to Bart.
Not no more, I don't, Mr. Packer.
Bart saw the six-shot Colt patent revolver trembling in the boy's hand. A huge sidearm, decades old, a relic from before the war.
"Easy, son," Bart said,
and though his intoxication had faded fast, he was far from clear-headed. He thought for a half second that maybe he'd been caught in a slide and was lying packed in snow, suffocating, hallucinating this nightmare.
"What in the holy hell are you doing? I don't understand."
The other man put his horse forward and rammed the barrel of the shotgun into Bart's face. Blood poured through his mustache, between his teeth, down his chin. Bart pulled off a glove and cupped his hand over his nose.
"God damn you, it's broke!"
"Now go on and drive the sled up to your mansion. We're gonna follow behind. Don't know if you got a shoulder scabbard, but I wouldn't advise reaching into your coat for any reason. Rest assured I'll err on the side of blowing your goddamn head off. Savvy?"
"What do you want? I'm a rich..."
"You remember what happened the last time you opened that mouth? Now go on."
Bart lifted the reins and urged his team up the trail, his nose burning, tears running down his bloodied face. The riders followed close behind, and they hadn't gone 50 feet when one of them retched into the snow. The other muttered,
"Christ almighty."
Bart didn't dare look back, but he figured it was the boy, wondered if he'd gotten sick because he was going to kill his first man tonight. 11. It was almost 10 o'clock, and Joss figured she'd seen all the customers she was going to see for the evening. But in no hurry to return to her cold jail cell, she didn't disturb the deputy, who still snoozed comfortably beside the stove. Lana had gone home for the night, and Joss hated to own up, but she missed the piano, sick as she was of the endless rotation of Christmas carols. Noise drowned out the hush of loneliness, though even loneliness was preferable to listening to that deputy blather on about what big shit he used to be down in Ouray. Joss had given serious consideration to cutting the young man's throat while he slept. One deep swipe with the bowie she kept under the bar. She could picture his eyes popping open, him reaching for the revolver that she'd already slipped out of its holster, the puddle of blood expanding on the floorboards, sizzling where it touched the base of the stove. But that would just fuck everything up. Besides, where would she go? With abandon as snowbound as she'd ever seen it? What was another 12 hours? Joss smiled at the thought of Lana. On her way out, she'd actually bowed her head and mouthed, "Merry Christmas," by far the most verbose that pretty mute had ever been. The front door swung open and the preacher walked inside and dusted the snow off his frock coat. Stephen Cole glanced around the dead saloon, then walked up and rested his forearms on the pine bar.
"Good evening," he said.
"Evening, preach. Finally come to bend an elbow?"
Stephen smiled. Apparently he'd left home without a hat, because his hair was wet with melting snow.
"Could I buy you a drink, Miss Maddox?"
"It's Joss. And yes, always. You off your feed?"
"No, why do you ask?"
"You're all gant up. Just about the palest thing I ever saw."
She placed a new bottle on the bar, withdrew the cork, and set up two tumblers.
"Pinch of cocaine with your whiskey?"
"No, thank you."
"Don't reckon I ever got booze blind with a man of God. Here's to you. Is it reverend or preacher or..."
"Stephen is fine, actually. Just Stephen."
They clinked and drained their glasses, Stephen wincing. Joss went to pour again, but Stephen waved her off.
"No more of that snakehead for me, but you go right ahead."
"I'll mix you a cobbler," she smiled. "Ladies seem to like it."
"No, I'm fine."
"Well, I'm gonna get a little more fine."
Joss filled her glass. The preacher pulled two bits from his leather pouch, set it on the bar, but he made no move to leave.
"There's something else I can help you with?"
she asked. Stephen pushed his hair behind his ears.
"Actually, I did have ulterior motives for coming here tonight."
"And what might those..."
"No.
Wait. Please, please tell me you ain't here to make some half-assed attempt to..."
"Save you? No. God saves. I am a very small part of that equation. Besides, it would be an insult to your intelligence for me to think I can convince you of your need for God. You're a smart woman. You've lived many a year in this world and have certainly heard the gospel at some point. You've chosen not to accept him. It saddens me, certainly saddens God, but you have free will. I respect that."
"Well, that's a relief to hear. I didn't relish the idea of throwing a gospel sharp out on his ass, but I was prepared to."
Stephen smiled.
"I understand you're to be sent back to Arizona in the spring to..."
"To be hanged. You ain't gonna hurt my feelings saying it."
"Miss Maddox, Joss, I was walking home tonight from the Christmas Eve dinner, and I saw the lamps glowing in your saloon, and God put it on my heart to come in here."
"He did?"
"I would like to pray for you, Joss, right now. It's Christmas Eve. You're chained up behind a bar. I can't imagine the fear you face at having to go back to Arizona next year. I thought I might say a prayer with you. If it could bring you any comfort at all, I would be most..."
Joss leaned toward Stephen.
"You think I rejected God?"
"I just..."
You said I had chosen not to come to God.
Well, I just assumed.
You want to hear a story about rejection? The cunt bitch who birthed me abandoned me in an alley in the California gold fields when I was a day old. Man who found and raised me put me up for $3 to any son of a bitch who had a taste for 10-year-old pussy. Every husband I ever had beat me. Now, the way I figure it, God either approved or couldn't be bothered to give a shit. So don't come in here talking to me about my rejection of God. I'd say he'd had his back on me ever since I took my first breath. A vein had risen on Joss's forehead and her big black eyes shone.
You think God hates you?
Stephen asked. I stopped caring what he thinks or don't think of me years ago.
Well, I can assure you that he loves.
Look, you don't gotta come down here hat in hand making amends for God. He knows where I live. He can come himself or not at all. Thanks for the gesture, Preach, but you're barking at a knot, and praying with you ain't exactly on my wish list this year. Now I gotta close up.
She looked at the deputy.
Al, get your ass up.
The deputy startled into consciousness, instinctively touched the revolver at his side, his words slurring.
What's wrong? What happened?
We're done for tonight, Joss said. Take me back to jail.
But it ain't, but...
Al, goddammit, contradict me one more fucking...
All right, Joss, you ain't gotta yell.
Stephen took a step back and regarded Joss with his sad, sweet eyes.
Merry Christmas to you, he said, and started for the door.
Stephen Cole stood under a street lamp, watching the wind build snowdrifts against the storefront of a vacated barbershop. Across the street, on the second floor of the hotel, Molly Madsen sat in the bay window, looking down at him, her face weakly illuminated by the candle in her hands. He waved, whispered a prayer for her. He followed the plank sidewalk for several blocks, then turned up the side street that led to his cabin. His mind brimmed with thoughts of his home in Charleston, South Carolina. The palm trees and live oaks and saltwater marshes. The ocean at sunrise. The faces of his father and mother. He had come west 3 years ago because he believed it to be the will of God, had felt compelled to minister to those who lived in these harsh environs. What he had found were 1,000 little towns high in the Rockies built upon debauchery and greed.
I've accomplished nothing, he thought. God, show me one life in these mountains that has benefited from my presence.
Overcome, he knelt in the empty street and prayed until his face had gone numb and his body shook with cold. Stephen rose to his feet and wiped the snow from his hair. He'd taken 2 steps toward home when he heard it. He froze, forgot that he was cold, forgot his loneliness. He just stood there in the darkness and falling snow, a strange warmth spreading through him. Having now heard it, he knew with certainty that all the other times, kneeling at the foot of his bed, sometimes hours in the silence, had been imagination and hoping. It was simply his own name that he'd heard, but it filled him with such blinding peace that he didn't question for a moment the source. When God speaks to you, his voice is unmistakable. 2009. 12. 6 tubes of light swung through the fog that had settled in the canyon. A colony of headlamps moving toward the ruins of abandon. The air carried the steel smell of snow, though none was yet falling. Night had arrived, moonless and overcast, with a darkness Abigail had never imagined possible out of doors. Like they'd all been locked into an immense, freezing closet. She walked between Emmett and June, with Lawrence a few yards ahead, the 2 guides relegated to the back, with orders to stay close but quiet. Abigail had brought along her tape recorder and was collecting background information from the Tozers when Lawrence said,
"Hold up."
They stopped. Lawrence shone his flashlight into the darkness ahead, the beam passing over a grove of spruce.
"Can't believe I found it in this fog. Here's what's left of the cabin of Ezekiel and Gloria Curtis."
Abigail followed June into the grove. The small woman, swallowed in a red ski jacket, aimed her light at the rubble. Abigail saw a cook stove, cans, rusted bed springs amid the detritus. Emmett slipped off his camera's lens cap and began to circle the homestead. Abigail said,
June, while Emmett's taking photos, could you tell me how you two got involved with paranormal photography?
June led Abigail away from the remains of the cabin. They stood apart from the others, separated by a lightning-fried spruce, headlamps off.
10 years ago, our son Tyler was out riding his bicycle in the neighborhood. He was hit by a van, died in the street.
Abigail found June's hands in the dark.
Night after the funeral, Emmett and I were in bed, holding each other. We were talking about taking some pills. It's a pain like you cannot... So we're in bed. It's 2 or 3 in the morning, and all of a sudden, I just feel this calm engulf me, like a rush of some incredible drug. The air was thick, a living thing, and I felt like I was being wrapped in it. That's the only way I know how to describe it. Most intense and unconditional love I've ever felt. And I was smiling, and I looked at Emmett, and he was too. We were experiencing it together, and we both knew exactly what it was. Ty had come to us. I felt my little boy's presence just as strong as I feel you standing here in front of me, even though I can't see you. He saved us, Abigail. Next morning at our local coffee house, Emmett saw a poster for a paranormal photography slideshow. We didn't even know there was such a thing, but having just had our experience with Ty, we felt this conviction to go. Unfortunately, the photographer we went to see was a fraud. I could tell that right away. Most people who claim to be psychic are delusional. The stuff they shoot, it's camera malfunctions, flash problems, dust particles on the film. But Emmett and I were inspired to buy a camera. We shot 4 rolls in our room that night, infrared film in total darkness. In the corner above our bed, we captured this fantastic pool of light, like this energy was watching over us as we slept. Your son.
Emmett and I had always been artists. It's why we lived in San Francisco. We threw ourselves into paranormal photography, never looked back. And it's such a beautiful medium, a perfect intersection of art and history and service.
What do you mean by service?
See, it isn't just about taking photographs of paranormal activity for the aesthetic value. These are suffering spirits who, for whatever reason, haven't passed to the other side. Most important part of our job is helping them move on. It's not about the thrills for us, or ghost-busting. It's our calling. If Ty hadn't died, we probably never would have come down this road. Isn't it beautiful and sad how these things work out?
June placed something in Abigail's hand, a small plastic cylinder.
What's this? Emmett shot a roll of film on the hike in.
Of me?
Of you and Lawrence.
Well, that's... Thank you, but to be honest, I don't know that I want this.
June squeezed her hands. Do as you see fit.
When Emmett finished shooting the Curtis homestead, the party moved on. 6 pairs of boots brushing through dry autumn weeds. They came down a slope, Abigail feeling guilty, convinced the death of the Tozer's son had turned them out of their minds, yet knowing their story would make the heartbreaking core of her article. Shapes took form out of the fog. They stood in the grassy lane, abandoned ramshackle buildings on either side, tendrils of mist drifting among them through the blaring silence.
Let's start in the saloon.
Emmett said, and Lawrence led them across the street, hopped over a few planks, all that remained of the sidewalk, and stepped gingerly into the shack.
I haven't been here in a while, he said, so I'm not sure how sturdy everything is. We'd better just start with the Tozers going in.
Emmett and June joined Lawrence inside. After a moment, Emmett appeared in the doorway, said,
Would everyone please turn off their headlamps? I don't want any outside light getting in here, interfering with the shots.
All the headlamps went dark except for Emmett's. Abigail stood on the threshold, watching them explore the interior, the beam of Emmett's light grazing the listing walls and a gnawed board floor, littered with pieces of broken whiskey bottles, rusted tin can scraps. The pine bar had toppled over and punched out a section of the back wall, through which the fog crept in,
giving the saloon a natural smokiness.
"You can come on in," Lawrence whispered to Abigail. "Just be mindful where you step and don't go near the stove. If you look up, you'll see a hole in the roof. The boards underneath get rained and snowed on. Amazing they haven't fallen through yet."
Abigail walked inside, the floor bowing beneath her weight. It smelled of mold and marmot urine and whatever the fog had carried in from the canyon. Emmett and June stood together by the wall opposite the pot-bellied stove near an upright piano, half of the ivory keys missing, the rest cracked and jagged like broken teeth. Emmett turned off his headlamp, the darkness filling with the click of exposures. While he shot the saloon, Abigail whispered to June,
"Are these spirits ever...
mean?" June laughed. "We get that question a lot. In all our years of work, we've encountered only one aggressive spirit. 99% of the time, they're just confused, lost, and consumed in their own grief. It's funny, because once you're dead, all the beliefs you subscribe to while alive don't mean a thing."
Abigail turned on her tape recorder. "Tell me about this aggressive experience."
"A few years ago, we got a call to clear a church outside Monterey. This spirit had been locking doors, moving furniture around, just making a nuisance of itself. So we showed up, and the preacher was there. This hardcore, fire-and-brimstone type of guy. He said, 'You tell me when you feel the presence, and I'll get rid of it. Show you how it's done.' I told him, 'Well, it's here right now.' And he said, 'By the power of Jesus Christ, I command you to leave.' A chair went flying across the sanctuary, shattered on the pulpit. That preacher ran out the doors, scared the hell out of him. He quit the church and everything."
"What do you think it was? A demon? Do you even believe in angels and demons?"
"Angels, yes. Demons, I'm not sure. Come to find out, this church had been converted from a nursing home. The spirit was probably tied up from whatever trauma it had experienced there when it was alive. But it certainly didn't like the church."
"How do you think it managed to throw a chair?"
Emmett piped up from across the room.
"These spirits, when they die, become pure mind. You know what we could do if we had access to even 80% of our brain?"
"You're talking about telekinesis."
"That's right."
"Have to say, I'm surprised by the lack of equipment you guys brought.
I did some research before I flew out, expected to see you using thermal scanners and Geiger counters, ion detectors, and EMF alarm."
"Let me tell you something," Emmett said.
"That's a bunch of garbage. All you need is a camera and film. Because if you can't walk into a room and feel it in your bones, you're in the wrong business, wasting your time."
When Emmett turned on his headlamp, Abigail noticed that June had been drawn over to one of the windows, where she stared at something across the street.
"Lawrence," June whispered, "what happened up there?"
They all walked over, peered up to where June pointed. Without light, they could barely make out a bay window on the second floor of a building across the street.
"Did something happen in that room?"
"Not that I know of. It was just one of the nicer rooms in the hotel. Why?"
"Someone's watching me from that window."
Even though she knew it wasn't real, a subtle chill moved down through the vertebrae of Abigail's spine.
"Can you get us up there?"
Emmett asked.
"Never been, but we can certainly try."
13. 119 years of rain, snow, and high-altitude sun had bleached the block letters on the side of the building, so all that could be seen by the light of the headlamps was a faint hotel. Excluding Bartholomew Packer's mansion, it was the largest, most resilient structure in the ghost town, a two-story brick building with what had once been a lavish dining room on the ground level and seven suites on the second floor. The middle of the three rooms that faced the street was the presidential suite, identifiable by the large bay window that loomed over the entrance to the hotel. Lawrence walked through the tall doorframe, the others following, and soon the party had gathered in the lobby. A long but narrow room with two archways opposite each other, a front desk, and a wide staircase that ascended into darkness.
"This was the only brick building in abandon," Lawrence said. "Built when the mine was still producing and people thought this town was going to last."
Abigail stepped through the archway on her left, her headlamp sweeping over the shambles of a lounge strewn with Victorian-style furniture and a long dormant hearth. Draperies hung in shreds from the windows, and a billiard table stood at a severe slant, one of its legs having snapped off. Abigail drew in a quick shot of oxygen. Eyes shone back at her, illumined in the beam. The head and rack of an enormous elk, fallen from its mount above the fireplace, stared at her, mottled with mold and decay. She returned to the lobby, where everyone had gathered at the other archway, this one opening into the dining room. It might have been the best restaurant in Abandon in the early 1890s, but tonight it lay before them in a mass of mangled tables and broken chairs. The three chandeliers had pulled out from their fixtures in the ceiling and shattered on the black and white striped hardwood floor, the tiny shards of glass and crystal glittering under the lamps, as if the party had stumbled into an ice cave. "Anyone care for a glass of 100-year-old bourbon?" The headlamps converged on Scott, who stood behind the mahogany bar, a dusty bottle in one hand. They made their way back through the carnage of furniture into the lobby. "Here's the deal," Lawrence said. "I've never explored the second floor, so we're going to take these stairs one person at a time. Be alert, be careful, and walk softly if you can." His right hand glided up the rickety banister as he climbed. The first four steps were fine, but they grew progressively creakier the higher he went. The last three made no sound at all, and then he stood at the top, just a moon of yellow light 15 feet above. "Who's next?" June went up, followed by Emmett. Abigail took the path Emmett had chosen, straight up the middle, her headlamp trained on each step.
"You're doing great," June called out as the fifth step creaked loudly and she felt the wood give beneath her.
The next three were even worse. She could feel her pulse accelerating and a shortness of breath brought on by the first stage of panic. Abigail climbed the final steps faster than she should have, but as she neared the top, Lawrence and Emmett reached down, each taking an arm, and pulled her to safety.
"That was sort of terrifying," she said.
Abigail stood with Lawrence at the edge of the steps, watching their guide ascend. He climbed toward them, a model of patience and confidence, a man at home on dangerous terrain, even when he crossed the noisiest steps. He was almost to the top now, and Abigail could see him grinning. He winked at her as he put his weight onto the last step. Then came a dry crack, and he simply disappeared. The staircase collapsed in a fanfare of splitting wood, dust everywhere, people shouting in the darkness. Coughing, Abigail aimed her headlamp down toward the lobby, half expecting to see Scott sprawled across the wreckage. At first, she mistook it for a cry of pain, but then she saw the gloved fingers gripping the edge of the second floor and realized that Scott was laughing, even as his feet dangled 7 feet above the fallen staircase.
"He's right here," she yelled. "Help him up."
Lawrence and Emmett dropped to their knees, grabbed Scott's arms above the elbows.
"Maybe I should just drop," Scott said. "It's not that far."
"Bad idea," Abigail said. "I see nails sticking out of the boards underneath you."
"Abigail," Lawrence said, "my grip's slipping. Get him under this arm."
They strained to lift him, inch by inch, sweating, groaning, swearing. Finally, Scott's knees cleared the ledge where the staircase had broken away, and they all fell back into the corridor. Jared yelled up to them,
"Everybody in one piece?"
"Yeah, we're cool," Scott said. "Why don't you come stand underneath us? I've got a rope in my pack. We'll hoist you up."
"I think I'll just wait down here."
Lawrence helped Abigail and June onto their feet, and soon they were all moving down the second floor corridor, testing with each step the fidelity of the floor. At last, Lawrence stopped at a closed door with a tarnished number 6 hanging upside down from a rusty nail. 14. The five of them filed in, their headlamps making swaths of light across the room, showing where the gingham wallpaper had peeled so thoroughly from the walls it resembled the curling bark of aspen trees. Aside from the broken bedposts and an upturned writing desk, the furniture had been well preserved. Water had damaged the ceiling and the south wall, and picture frames lay on the floor, their canvases gone or destroyed. On the door frame, Abigail's headlamp fell upon some tiny scrawl that she wrote off as graffiti. "Something awful happening."
Honey, can you get over the heaviness? Emmett said. I know. It's much colder in here. Room's really sagging. Why are certain places paranormal hotspots? Abigail whispered.
Usually because of intense, unresolved emotion, Emmett said.
June had wandered over to an enormous wardrobe, which she opened. Inside hung petticoats and evening gowns, so eaten by time they'd have evaporated in a gust of wind. In a corner near the bed, Abigail gazed at a collection of porcelain figurines on top of a bureau, wondering how they'd remained untouched all these years. Beside them, face down, lay a small frame, its picture gone. Lawrence came up behind her and whispered,
"Do you feel anything in here?" "Loads of bullshit."
They turned and watched June approach the bay window, where, remarkably, only one pane of glass had been busted out. A divan stood in utter disintegration in the alcove.
"She'd sit here," June said quietly, as if to herself, "watching the world go by without her."
She crumpled down on the floor and rested her head between her knees. After a while, she rose into child's pose and bowed her head. Abigail muttered, "Jesus Christ," under her breath. Emmett walked over to Abigail and Lawrence.
"You really don't know anything about the history of this room? Even the smallest detail might help."
Lawrence shook his head. "I'm sorry, I know a lot about abandon, but there are gaps."
"Why don't you two go ahead and turn off your lights? I'm going to take some photos."
They all turned off their headlamps. The room went dark, Emmett just a shadow now, quiet save for the floor creaking beneath his footfalls, the clicking of his camera, and the deep, rhythmic breaths June emitted as she knelt motionless before the bay window. Abigail's eyes had just begun to adjust to the darkness when Emmett finished.
"I can't wait to process this film," he whispered. "I think I got something."
"What kind of camera are you using?" Abigail asked. "I'll need to get all the technical information right for my article."
"This is a Minolta X700. Only reason I use the older stuff is because it doesn't have all the electronic hardware, so it doesn't fool with the film. Infrared is so sensitive, you can't even shoot it in most of the newer cameras."
"Now, what exactly is infrared? It keys off hot and cold, right?"
"No, infrared is just outside the visible spectrum of light, so our eyes can't see it."
"She hears a church bell," June whispered. "She watches them all move past, but she won't leave." "Any special lens?"
"This is a 28-70. Sometimes I'll use a 50mm, depending on the conditions. Here, take a look."
He lifted the strap over his neck and handed the camera to Abigail. She brought the viewfinder up to her left eye.
"I can't see anything."
"Lawrence, turn on your flashlight."
Lawrence flicked it on.
"Cool, it's red," she said.
"Yeah, that's the number 25 filter.
June got up suddenly and went back to the open wardrobe, began fingering one of the evening gowns, her face still radiating a blank, trance-like intensity. With June out of the way, Abigail took the opportunity to walk over to the bay window. From the vantage point, she could see down through old glass onto the street below. She lifted Emmett's camera and stared through the viewfinder.
"Lawrence, can you give me some light, please?"
He came over and shined his flashlight at the saloon across the street.
"You know, I want to apologize, Emmett," Lawrence said, "for fucking with you last night about the spaceship and abandon."
"It's all right."
"No, I was being a dick. Let me share with you my theory on what happened."
"You sure?"
"Yeah. Now, I'd have been laughed out of academia if I'd ever published this."
Where the beam passed, the night glowed in deep reds, and Abigail suddenly knew she would write about this moment. What it felt like to gaze into the viewfinder through the number 25 filter, searching for lost spirits in the sea of red. Maybe Emmett wasn't actually looking for spirits when he snapped his photos, but she could embellish. Make his whole bizarre profession sound sexy and strange. She had the first inkling that this could be a phenomenal piece.
"But because of the way the town disappeared, everything abruptly abandoned, no record of what happened, no bones."
Something stepped out of the saloon and ran up the street. She lowered the camera.
"I came to the conclusion that..."
"Lawrence, you see that?"
"What?"
Emmett came over.
"What's wrong?"
he asked.
Something just came out of the saloon and ran up the street.
Probably a deer, said Scott, who'd been leaning against the wall by the door, quietly observing. Tons of wildlife out.
It didn't move like a deer.
How'd it move?
Like a man. You didn't see it, Lawrence? It moved right through where you were shining the flashlight.
I didn't see a thing.
Abigail handed Emmett his camera and walked through the suite and out the open door, moving quickly down the hallway to where the staircase had previously merged with the second floor.
Hey!
She called down into the dark lobby. Jared had extinguished his headlamp. Abigail turned hers on, directing her light across the collapsed staircase to the front desk, where he'd been standing several minutes ago.
Did you see something out there?
Her words trailed into silence. She swept her beam of light at each archway.
Jared?
She called out. A shadow moved down the corridor toward her.
Scott?
Yeah.
Jared left.
Scott came and stood beside her, flipped on his headlamp, moved his light across the lobby.
Jared!
He yelled, then cupped his mouth, shouted again.
Jared! Where'd you go?
Abigail heard the others emerge from the suite.
What's wrong?
June asked as they approached.
Jared's gone.
The five remaining members of the party peered down into the lobby, listening. Lawrence finally said,
You think something happened?
Scott knelt down, unzipped his backpack, and dug out a climbing rope. I'll see what's going on. Standing there, watching Scott unspool the rope, Abigail realized the soberness in his voice unnerved her. He jogged into the nearest suite, wrapped the rope three times around a heavy chest of drawers, and tied a knot. Then he came back out into the corridor and kicked the pile of rope. It dropped 15 feet into the lobby. He got onto his knees, worked himself over the edge, his gloved hands gripping the rope. He slid carefully down onto the wrecked staircase.
If you guys just want to wait up there, I'll be back in a minute.
Hold up, Lawrence said. I'll go with you.
The older man didn't make lowering himself look as effortless as the guide had, but he got down safely, and the two men disappeared out the front door of the hotel. June, Emmett, and Abigail sat down in the corridor.
I hope everything's all right, June said.
Emmett looked over at Abigail.
You got extra batteries for your light? Back at camp. Why?
Yours is dying.
Abigail pulled off her headlamp just in time to watch the bulb fade out. 15. Abigail pressed the light feature on her watch. 9:59 p.m.
They've been out there 10 minutes, she whispered.
June and Emmett had turned off their headlamps to conserve the batteries, so all she could see of them were the white pairs of facing crescent moons that framed their irises. From one of the rooms on the second floor came a sound like a shutter slamming against a window frame. Emmett said,
Wind.
They sat a while longer in the corridor, listening to the shutter squeak on its rusted hinges and bang into the window. Finally, Emmett struggled to his feet.
Okay, I'm gonna go down and see what's going on here.
No, Abigail said. We'll all go.
June went first, Emmett and Abigail helping her to ease over the edge, her hands trembling as she cursed quietly to herself while her feet dangled above the lobby. She slid slowly down the rope and whispered,
Thank you, God,
as her feet touched the staircase. When Emmett and Abigail had lowered themselves into the lobby, the three worked their way over the staircase debris, past the front desk, to the hotel entrance. They moved through the threshold and out into the misty street. The loose shutter had gone quiet, and abandon stood in perfect silence, save for the occasional creak of a teetering building bracing against the wind.
Where'd you guys go?
Emmett shouted. No answer but that of his own voice resounding in fading refrains through the canyon. He shouted again, echoes again. Silence. Abigail felt something soft and cold on her face. Snowflakes passed through the beam of Emmett's headlamp.
Well, he said finally, I'll walk up the street toward camp. June, you and Abigail head the other way. We have whistles in our emergency kits, so I suppose we should blow on those if we find the others.
I think splitting up is a horrible idea, Abigail said.
All right, then which way do you...
Emmett stopped mid-sentence.
What the hell?
He looked past them now, his brow deeply furrowed, his mouth dropped open. Something staggered toward them down the middle of the street, and it occurred to Abigail that the way it moved through the fog, in slow, exaggerated steps, resembled something from a horror movie, a zombie, or some demon that had just crawled out of its own grave. It was close now, within 10 feet of them, dragging its right foot and clutching its side. Their guide collapsed in the hotel doorway, Scott's yellow fleece slicked with blood and down blowing out of a gaping tear in his vest. Abigail felt her stomach lurch, something rising up her throat. Her mouth tasted of salt and metal. Emmett was already on his knees, cradling Scott's head.
"What happened?"
he asked. Scott moaned, his face so drained of color that it seemed to glow in the dark, his body quaking with the onset of shock.
"I want to see it," he gasped. "Lift my jacket."
Emmett unbuttoned Scott's down vest and unzipped his fleece jacket, Abigail at his ear whispering to him that everything would be okay. Emmett peeled away the layer of thermal underwear and they all stared at the black hole in his side, blood sheeting down his pale abdomen into a widening pool on the old boards.
"Fuck," Scott said. "Fuck, it hurts." "What do we do?" Abigail asked. "You're our guide. You know first aid, right? Tell us how to help you."
Scott's eyes rolled back in his head. She slapped his face. He came back, his eyes only slits now.
"Run,"
Scott hissed.
"They're coming."
"Who?" Abigail asked. "We aren't leaving you," Emmett said. But Scott's eyes had already closed.
"Scott? Scott!
June, keep pressure on the wound." She pressed her palm into Scott's side, blood leaking between her fingers. A scream blasted through the canyon. Abigail whispered,
"Turn off your headlamp, Emmett."
He did. Everything still, and for the moment, quiet. A snowflake landed on Abigail's eyelash. She blinked it away and rose to her feet.
"We need to get out of here," she said.
"There," June said. Abigail saw it too. 50 yards ahead, at the north edge of town, something sprinted toward them. Arms pumping.
"It's Jared," Emmett said.
Abigail had begun to backpedal even before she saw the shadows emerge out of the fog behind Jared. The one in front slipped something out of its belt. As it reached him, it placed a hand on the back of Jared's head, jammed something into the base of his skull. Jared dropped without a sound. June released an involuntary whimper. Emmett said, "Oh my God." Abigail thinking, "This is not happening. This is not happening." But it was. The shadows had passed Jared's body and were now closing fast on the hotel.
"We need to split up and run," Abigail said. "Right now."
16. The ghost town screamed by in a blur of fog. Abigail glanced over her shoulder, saw movement in the mist, though she couldn't tell if they were still chasing her. She had put 100 yards between herself and the hotel when she veered off the main street and bent over. Having come from sea level in Manhattan, the thin air of abandon crippled her lungs. She crawled through a hole in the side of a building, tried to turn on her headlamp, then remembered the bulb had burned out. It took a moment for the faintest suggestion of shapes to appear. A table, dismembered chairs, tall windows, remnants of a stove. Abigail stood in the dance hall. At the far end, the ceiling had collapsed and crushed a small stage. Footsteps approached from outside. With quick, careful strides, Abigail traversed the rotten floorboards. Some creaked under her weight, and she couldn't help but think of the staircase in the hotel, how suddenly it had given way. She stopped where the floor had fallen through, looked back toward the double doors that opened out onto the street. Abigail couldn't hear the footsteps anymore, only her accelerated breathing. The sound of whispering passed through the broken windows and something ran by on the street. She dropped down through the hole in the floor, a nail catching on her parka, ripping through the sleeve, her pink fleece jacket, her long johns, all the way to her skin. With less than 3 feet of space between the floorboards and the ground, she crawled away from the hole, through puddles of freezing water, until she found a dry spot. Crouched in the darkness, shivering under the floor of the dance hall, she felt a warm trail of blood meandering down her right arm. Her breathing still sounded deafening, but she couldn't stop herself. The darkness sparked with her own dizziness.
What happened to Lawrence? She wondered what had happened to her father.
The floor creaked above her. Abigail held her breath, her pulse thrumming against the back of her eyes. The floor moved again. She raised her hand to see how near it dipped to the top of her head. Her fingers passed between the boards, touched the tread of a boot. She froze. For a full minute, no movement, no sound. Her quads were cramping.
They're listening. Did I make a noise? Can they hear my heartbeat?
The cut on her right arm stung. Sweat ran down into her eyes and she shut them tightly against the burn. This made her think of growing up in the suburbs of Baltimore. She'd been a tomboy, and on Friday nights, in the summer of her 10th year, she would meet the neighborhood boys at a city park to play something they'd invented, called the Dead Game. One kid was named the Killer, and everyone else had 1 minute to run and hide. The Killer would then go hunting, and if he touched you, you were dead and had to lie on the ground until he'd caught everyone. She recalled hiding under a sliding board one night, watching the Killer pass by, and the exhilaration, the pretend fear that had flooded through her. The boot lifted and she listened to the footsteps trail away. As she huddled in the darkness, trying to fathom what was happening, she heard June's voice at the other end of abandon, shouting her husband's name. For a moment she considered hiding there indefinitely, days if she had to. But what if they've seen me? What if they know I'm somewhere in town? In daylight, it won't take them more than a few hours to search every structure. Safer to escape now, in the dark. Abigail remembered her cell phone, which was sitting in the top compartment of her backpack in the vestibule of her tent. She probably wouldn't get service in this canyon, but earlier today, when they'd crested the pass, she'd gotten a signal, even called her mother. Abigail crawled back through the puddles and the dirt to the hole in the floor, rising up slowly until only her eyes peeked out. The dance hall appeared empty. June's screaming had stopped. Even the wind had died away. Abigail scrambled up onto the floor. She felt safer, less exposed on her stomach, so she crawled along on her belly back to the hole in the wall she'd come through. She peered through the busted clapboard out into the fog. It would be too dangerous to run back to camp through town. She'd have to follow the side street, climb the slope, and stay above abandon as she worked her way up canyon. Then she could go straight down the hill into camp, know before she arrived if anyone was there. Her battery was charged. If she had a signal, she'd call 911, but assuming she didn't, it might be an hour up to the pass. Abigail took a moment to calm herself, filling her lungs with oxygen in preparation for the run. She tried to ignore it, but the thought forced itself on her.
They see me, I'm dead.
Abigail ducked through the hole and stepped outside. She jogged down the side street. 5 more seconds and she'd be out of the ghost town. Something darted out from behind the dance hall. A hand covered her mouth.
It's me, Abby.
Lawrence's voice. He pulled her down behind the building. She said,
Jared's dead, and Scott's hurt bad.
Wood creaked in a structure across the street.
Listen, Lawrence said. There's a house up that slope with a bay window in front. I want you to go there, hide inside, get out of the open.
My headlamp's out.
Take my flashlight.
What about you?
I tweaked my ankle. You'll move faster without me. Here.
He handed her his day pack.
There's a gun inside and a box of rounds.
I can't.
You can if you want to live. There's a button on the left side of the Ruger. Press it. Cylinder flips open, you put the shells in. It's double action, no safety, just squeeze back the hammer and fire. Now listen, when I say run, you go and you don't stop and you don't look back, no matter what happens. I'll go a different way, try to meet you in the house, we'll figure something out.
Footsteps moved toward them up the side street.
What's happening here, Lawrence? Who are these?
I don't know, but you have to get going. Now run.
Abigail scrambled to her feet, shouldered the pack and took off. Soon she was passing wiry firs and vacant cabins, dreary and haunted-looking in the freezing fog, fighting with every step the urge to look back. She suddenly emerged onto a long, narrow glissade, lost her footing on the old ice, and slid upside down on her back, racing toward the bottom. The ice ended, but she still tumbled through the scree, finally crashing into a boulder. Blood streamed down her face from a gash above her left eyebrow. Down in abandon, someone screamed. She got up, pushed on, nearing the timberline, with the ghost town 100 feet below, scarcely visible through the fog. Just ahead was the house with the bay window, 2 stories still intact. She glanced back. Too dark and foggy to see a thing. She came up on the house, saw a doorway toward the back of the old structure, slipped inside, scrambling over a pile of boards into a large empty room. She could see the bay window. 4 glassless rectangles with a view of the ghost town. She dropped the daypack on the floor and glanced through a window frame on the side of the house, spotted movement at the base of the slope she'd just climbed. 2 black specks slinking through the shrubs. She lost them amid the ruins of a homestead, then picked them up a moment later, larger, and close enough that she could see their deformed eyes, protruding long and sharp like fangs. Night vision goggles. They know I'm in here. Abigail knelt down in the corner and unzipped the daypack, shone the flashlight inside, saw the dull gleam of the revolver. She didn't realize how badly her hands were trembling until she tried to grab the gun. Holding the flashlight between her knees, she tore open the box of .357 Magnum rounds. Hollow point shells spilled across the floorboards, most of them disappearing into a hole. She felt the button on the left side of the frame, pushed it. The cylinder swung open. With her hand shaking, it took 3 tries to get the first round into the chamber. Footsteps approached. Abigail pushed in 3 more shells, wondered if she'd even loaded them correctly, having never held a gun until this moment. With the 6 chambers loaded, she pushed the cylinder back and stood up. Through the window, she saw it was snowing now, and the 2 shadows were much closer, less than 20 yards downhill. They moved up a steep section of the slope, climbing on all 4s like spiders up the mountain. She turned off the flashlight, hunched down in a corner, knees drawn into her chest. Thumbed back the hammer, total dark save for the faint outline of night through the bay windows. Blood running into her eyes. Outside, rocks shifted. She couldn't slow her breathing down. Her chest was heaving, hyperventilating. You have to be quiet. You have to. She closed her eyes, stilled her mind. Her heart followed. Then came the awful silence. No more whispering voices or clandestine footsteps or distant screaming. Ice pellets ticked against the house, pinged on the tin roof. She waited. 1 minute passed, and the image took hold again. That shadow thrusting something into the back of Jared's head. It wasn't just the brutality that horrified her. Why is this bugging me? She remembered. Oh, Jesus. One of the interviews she'd conducted for her article on PTSD vets had been with a colonel in Spec Ops. They'd stumbled onto the topic of the silent kill. And he told her that, contrary to common belief, slitting a throat wasn't the quietest way to kill a person. He'd explained that when force recon or SEALs wanted to kill instantly and with minimal noise, they'd jam a combat knife at a 45-degree angle through the base of the skull, where the bone was thin. It scrambled the medulla oblongata, instantly wiped out all motor control. That's what happened to Jared. Are these guys Spec Ops? In the darkness several feet ahead, someone exhaled. The floor creaked. Liquid fear pulled the trigger, muzzle flash burning her eyes, ears ringing, and in that light splinter she saw the rotted interior of the ghost house and 2 men garbed in night camouflage and face masks, suppressor-fitted machine pistols slung over their shoulders. They stood by the bay window, 1 of them kneeling, hit. As she thumbed back the hammer, she heard the hiss of compressed air. Barbed electrodes clung to her parka. Then she lay twitching and screaming on the floor. 1893. 17. Molly Madsen sat in her bay window watching snow pour down onto Maine, sipping from a bottle of wine of coca. It had stormed all night. She'd even startled from sleep once, awakened by a slide raising the forest below town. An untrodden lacquer of powder lay between the buildings, and on the hillside she could see the cabins. Stoves and hearths aglow, smoke trickling out of chimneys. Here came the first passerby of the day, a petite blonde plodding through the snow. That pretty piano player. Molly had grown accustomed to staring down into the saloon, watching the young woman play. Sometimes, late at night, with the street gone quiet, she could even hear the music from the hotel suite. Footsteps approached from behind, strong hands settling on her shoulders. She finished peeling one of the oranges from the basket Ezekiel and Gloria Curtis had left at her door the night before, offered him a wedge, her sweet redolent of citrus.
"I was thinking, Jack. Could we take a trip to San Francisco this spring? I'm so tired of all this dreadful snow."
"That's a lovely idea."
She squeezed his hand. Jack gazed down at her, eyes luminous with adoration, said, "Remember the first time I saw you? I was walking down that street on a San Francisco evening when I passed this spectacular creature. I doffed my hat, smiled."
"Did she smile back?"
"Oh, no. This was a lady by every account. She simply nodded, and I thought, I have to know who that woman is."
"So what did you do?"
"Followed her to a ball."
"And then?"
"We danced. We danced all night."
"Do you remember what she wore?"
"An evening gown the color of roses. You were the most exquisite thing I'd ever seen. You still are."
"I'm so happy, Jack."
Molly rose from the divan and stepped around to her husband. Even after all this time, he seemed utterly unchanged from the man she'd married in 1883. Short blonde hair, boxy jaw, ice blue eyes, even that same spruce tailcoat he'd worn the night of their first encounter.
"Let me show you what I want for Christmas,"
she said, reaching back to untie her filthy corset, letting it fall to her feet. She pulled her chemise over her head, tossed it at the wardrobe, and climbed into bed.
"Jack,"
she whispered his name like a prayer, fingers already fast at work in that swampy heat between her thighs. 18. On their way to Packer's mansion for a Christmas brunch, Ezekiel and Gloria Curtis eyed the steep treeless slopes that swept up on both sides of the trail, listening for the first hint of the breaking snow that would precede a slide. Lying in bed in their fire-warmed cabin, they'd heard them going throughout the night, like the thunder of distant cannons. Stephen Cole sent up a prayer for protection as they moved into the treacherous gap between the mountains, their webs sinking through a foot and a half of powder with every step. When they emerged from the avalanche path, the party stopped to rest near a spring that erupted out of the rock. Ezekiel and Stephen packed down an area of snow so they could sit without sinking. Then the preacher dipped an Indian earthenware vessel he'd brought into the spring, offered the first sip to Gloria.
"No, thank you. I'm afraid it'll chill me down even more."
"Zeke?" "Nah, preach. You go ahead."
They sat in the cold and awesome silence. Ezekiel pulled off his fleece-lined gloves, took out a hip flask tin of Prince Albert tobacco, set to work loading his pipe. Ahead, the terrain flattened into a high basin, with a lake in the middle that in the summer turned a luminescent green, as though the lake bed were made of solid emerald, with the sun underneath it. Even then, no one could stand the water for more than a minute, leading the residents of Abandon to bestow it with the most extreme temperature designation in their arsenal. Fucking cold. Gloria tucked in the blonde curls that had escaped from her sealskin cap. Shivering despite having bundled herself in two petticoats, two pairs of stockings, one of Ezekiel's heavy woolen jackets, and an enormous pommel slicker.
"Mind if I ask you something, Stephen?"
"Gloria, you can ask me anything, anytime."
Ezekiel blew smoke rings, watched the snowflakes cut them down.
"If I tell you this, can it stay between us? 'Cause nobody else in Abandon knows what I'm about to say."
"What do you think you're doing, Glory?" Ezekiel said.
"Trying to ask the preacher something."
"Don't go bothering him with..."
"Zeke," said Stephen, "let us say what's on our mind. I'm here to help if I can."
"Glory, I wish you'd let it lie," Ezekiel said, but she ignored him.
"There's no easy way to say it, Stephen. I used to be a whore."
"Oh, hell," Ezekiel said.
"And Zeke used to be an outlaw, killed a few men in his time. We each did enough sinning for 10. We changed, not perfect by any means, but we're decent folk now, or try to be at least."
"I believe that," Stephen said as he brushed the snow off his visored felt hat. Reason I'm telling you this is 'cause I want to know about God's punishment.
What about it in particular?
Something happened a year ago.
Ain't gonna listen to this, Ezekiel said, and he struggled to his feet and webbed a ways up the trail, where he stood with his back to them, smoking his pipe, watching the basin fill with snow.
Go on, Gloria, Stephen said.
Last January we were living up in Silver Plume, had a son named Gus. Him and Zeke went out together one morning. They were waiting across the street, and somehow Gus's little hand slipped out of Zeke's. Our boy walked in front of a hansom.
Stephen reached over, touched Gloria's arm. She wiped her eyes.
The horse stepped on Gus, and one of them big wheels rolled over his neck. Weren't nobody's fault. Not the driver's. Not Zeke's.
Not yours.
Gus died right there in the street.
I'm so sorry, Gloria.
Now, I want you to tell me something, Stephen.
I'll certainly try.
I just told you how Zeke and I used to be a wicked pair of souls. There's this little voice been whispering to me ever since he died, saying that God took Gus from us as punishment for all the bad things we'd done. That ain't true, is it? He ain't that kind of a God.
The preacher's calm brown eyes seemed to darken. He looked away, and when he spoke again, his voice took on a harder, bitter aspect. You're asking me if we worship a vengeful God?
Yes.
I don't think I'm the person to answer that for you.
Why not?
What if I were to say that that voice in your head is right? That it's entirely possible he took your son from you?
If that's the truth, I hate myself and Zeke for what we were, and I hate God for what he is.
Then perhaps we shouldn't continue this conversation, Gloria. I'll not be responsible for turning someone from their faith. Stephen used his walking stick to boost him onto his feet.
I'm sorry I can't be more comfort to you.
But just last week you preached about God's unconditional love. Stephen reached down, extended a gloved hand to Gloria, helped her stand.
It's what people need to hear. They want a version of God as benevolent father, ready to protect, eager to provide, but to hold no accounting. I don't believe in that God anymore.
But you did last Sunday. So something changed your mind?
Not something, Gloria. God himself.
And there were sparks in the preacher's gentle eyes, deep loss and rage at that loss, as he turned away and trudged up the trail. 19. Emerald Lake lay 10 feet under the snow beneath their webs. The storm eased as they hiked across, and through a hole in the clouds a shaft of sunlight passed, firing into blinding white a piece of the serrated ridge that enclosed the basin. A mansion materialized in the distance, ensconced on the edge of the lake.
Every time I see it, Ezekiel said, I can't get past what a load of Burroughs milk that thing is.
It does look misplaced in these environs, Stephen said. Packer had named his estate Emerald House. Four symmetrical wings of opulence that met in a central block, crowned by a cupola. The top floors had been cedar shingled, the ground level constructed of stone. Numerous brick chimneys soared from the gabled roof.
Well, that's strange, Ezekiel said. Y'all see even a whisper of smoke rising from one of them chimneys? Why, you reckon he'd let his fires go out in a storm?
There were drifts to the second-floor windows, and a snow tunnel with 15-foot walls had been shoveled to the portico of unbarked Douglas fir trunks. They arrived at a pair of oak doors, and Stephen rapped the knocker 3 times. They untied their webs, waited. Stephen banged the knocker again. Gloria glanced up at the long, overhanging eaves, said,
"You don't think he forgot?"
The preacher speculated.
Perhaps he stayed in town last night, not wanting to chance getting trapped in a slide on the way home.
Well, we just hoofed it through a blizzard, and I'm gonna by God walk in there, find out if we're getting breakfast for our trouble.
Ezekiel grabbed one of the large iron handles, tried the door. It opened.
Think we should walk in unannounced, Zeke?
Gloria said.
Yeah, I do. He stepped through.
Gloria sighed, followed him in with Stephen, and closed the door. Every kerosene lamp had burned down save for one at the far end of the first floor in the kitchen. Just a wink of fire from where they stood. Soft gray light slanted through the tall windows that framed the foyer.
Hello? Ezekiel shouted. Anybody on the premises?
His voice resounded through Emerald House. They made their way through the foyer and up a cascading stairway, beneath rafters of fir timbers. At the confluence of the four wings, a staircase switchbacked up the heart of the mansion. Between the stairs, a rectangle of weak light fell upon the marble floor, having passed through a skylight 50 feet above.
Cold in here, Stephen said. Hasn't been a fire in a while. And shouldn't there be some servants? If I'm not mistaken, Bart keeps a staff of 4 or 5 ladies through the winter.
He walked to the north wing, peered through French doors into a great room furnished with a chaise lounge, sofas, parlor chairs. The opposite wing encompassed a dining room on a par with a feudal banqueting hall. Ezekiel looked in but glimpsed only the chairs and the long, broad table, naked of tablecloth, silverware, china.
Our breakfast and prospects ain't appearing promising. Let's check Bart's room. You remember where it is, Preach?
I believe it's in the east wing of the next floor. Overlooks the tarn.
What do you bet he bent an elbow in the saloon all night, came home roostered? Ezekiel said. Hell, might have to wake him.
They took the steps up to the second floor, calling out hellos as they started toward Bart's wing, not a single lamp in operation to illuminate Packer's extravagance. Ezekiel suddenly stopped.
Might want to step back there, Glory.
She looked down at the hardwood floor, saw that her arctic stood in a gooey puddle of blood. She leaped back toward her husband, brought her hand to her mouth to stifle the scream.
Well, that's an empty saddle, he said. Look, more.
Faint tracks of blood led back to the staircase, up the next flight.
Bring your revolver? Stephen asked.
Afraid not. Didn't think I'd be needing it of a Christmas morn. Tell you what, I'm gonna go see what in hell's going on here.
Zeke, no.
Glory?
By the way he said her name, with a gravity she'd not heard in years, Glory knew better than to push the issue.
Y'all don't move from this spot, savvy?
As Ezekiel ascended toward the servants' quarters, he filled with an exhilaration he'd not experienced in some time. It wasn't fear. He couldn't recall ever having been plagued by that emotion, even as a younker in Virginia. But an airiness in his stomach, birthed by the anticipation of something he'd always had a taste for, and still did. It reminded him of the rough old days, helling around with the boys. In all honesty, he had to own up to missing aspects of his former self. Much as he loved Gloria and his life with her, he couldn't recall the last time he'd felt this alive. Ezekiel reached the penultimate floor, but the blood continued up, sticky little pools of it on the steps and banister. He climbed on, following the drops and spatters to a small cupola that Bart had transformed into a library, the first 7 feet of each wall lined with books, the last 5 sloping up to a hipped roof. It made no sense. Blood on the floor, on the spines of books, entrails draped across the back of a leather chair. But the library was empty. Its 2 hearths fireless and the top floor cold enough to cloud his breath. Then he noticed the ladder tucked under a long bookshelf, glanced up, saw a trap door beside the skylight in the ceiling, almost smiled at the needles in his stomach. Using a shiny 8-foot brass pole with a hooked end, he reached up and unlatched the lock and pushed open the hatch. Then he stood the ladder up, bracing it against the opening, snow already falling into the library.
This is the end of disc number 2. Please insert disc number 3.